Chapter 15. Distracted me from my own share in the situation, and it was with dismay that I suddenly caught the drift of her assumptions. She expected me to buy the Rembrandt for the museum, as he had taken my previous valuation as a tentative bid, and when I came to my senses she was in the act of accepting my offer. Had I had $1,000 of my own to dispose of, the bargain would have been concluded on the spot, but I was in the impossible position of being materially unable to buy the picture, and morally unable to tell her that it was not worth acquiring for the museum. I dashed into the first evasion in sight. I had no authority, I explained, to purchase pictures for the museum without the consent of the committee. Mrs. Fontage coped for a moment in silence with the incredible fact that I had rejected her offer. Then she ventured, with a kind of pale precipitation, "But I understood Miss Cobb tells me that you practically decide such matters for the committee." I could guess what the effort had cost her. My cousin is given to generalizations. My opinion may have some weight with the committee. "Well, then," she timidly prompted, "for that very reason I can't buy the picture." She said, with a drooping note, "I don't understand." "Yet you told me," I reminded her, "that you knew museums didn't buy unsigned pictures. Not for what they are worth. Everyone knows that." "But I understood the price you named." Her pride shuddered back from the abasement. "It's a misunderstanding then," she faltered. To avoid looking at her, I glanced desperately at the Rembrandt. Could I? But reason rejected the possibility. Even if the committee had been blind, and they all were but Crozier, I simply shouldn't have dared to do it. I stood up, feeling that to cut the matter short was the only alleviation within reach. Mrs. Fontage had summoned her indomitable smile, but its brilliance I dropped as I opened the door, like a candle blown out by a draft. "If there's anyone else, if you knew anyone who would care to see the picture, I should be most happy." She kept her eyes on me, and I saw that, in her case, it hurt less than to look at the Rembrandt. I shall have to leave here, you know," she panted, "if nobody cares to have it." 3. That evening at my club I had just succeeded in losing sight of Mrs. Fontage in the fumes of an excellent cigar, when a voice at my elbow evoked her harassing image. "I want to talk to you," the speaker said, "about Mrs. Fontage's Rembrandt." "There isn't any," I was about to growl, but looking up I recognized the confiding countenance of Mr. Jefferson Rose. Mr. Rose was known to me chiefly as a young man suffused with a vague enthusiasm for virtue and my cousin Eleanor. One glance at his glossy exterior conveyed the assurance that his morals were as immaculate as his complexion and his linen. Goodness exuded from his moist eye, his liquid voice, the warm damp pressure of his trustful hand. He had always struck me as one of the most uncomplicated organisms I had ever met. His ideas were as simple and inconsecutive as the propositions in a primer, and he spoke slowly, with a kind of uniformity of emphasis that made his words stand out like the raised type for the blind. An obvious incapacity for abstract conceptions made him peculiarly susceptible to the magic of generalization, and one felt he would have been at the mercy of any cause that spelled itself with a capital letter. It was hard to explain how, with such a superabundance of merit, he managed to be a good fellow. I can only say that he performed the astonishing feat as naturally as he supported an invalid mother and two sisters on the slender salary of a banker's clerk. He sat down beside me with an air of bright expectancy. "It's a remarkable picture, isn't it?" he said. "You've seen it?" "I've been so fortunate. Miss Cobb was kind enough to get Mrs. Fontage's permission. We went this afternoon." I inwardly wished that Eleanor had selected another victim, unless indeed the visit were part of a plan whereby some third person, better equipped for the cultivation of delusions, was to be made to think the Rembrandt remarkable. Knowing the limitations of Mr. Rose's resources, I began to wonder if he had any rich aunts. and her buying it in that way too, he went on with his limpid smile, from that old countess in Brussels, makes it all the more interesting, doesn't it? Miss Kopp tells me it's very seldom old pictures can be traced back for more than a generation. I suppose the fact of Mrs. Fontage's knowing its history must add a good deal to its value? Uncertain as to his drift, I said, colon in her eyes it certainly appears to. Implications are lost on Mr. Rose, who glowingly continued, colon that's the reason why I wanted to talk to you about it, to consult you. Miss Kopp tells me you value it at $1,000. There was no denying this, and I grunted a reluctant assent. Of course, he went on earnestly, your valuation is based on the fact that the picture isn't signed. Mrs. Fontage explained that, and it does make a difference, certainly. But the thing is, if the picture's really good, ought one to take advantage? I mean, one can see that Mrs. Fontage is in a tight place, and I wouldn't for the world. My astonished stare arrested him. You wouldn't, I mean, you see, it's just this way. He coughed and blushed, colon, I can't give more than $1,000 myself. It's as big a sum as I can manage to scrape together, but before I make the offer I want to be sure I'm not standing in the way of her getting more money. My astonishment lapsed to dismay. Why, you're going to buy the picture for $1,000? His blush deepened. Why, yes. It sounds rather absurd, I suppose. It isn't much in my line, of course. I can see the picture's very beautiful, but I'm no judge. It isn't the kind of thing, naturally, that I could afford to go in for. But in this case I'm very glad to do what I can. The circumstances are so distressing, and knowing what you think of the picture, I feel it's a pretty safe investment, I don't think. I blurted out. I don't think the picture's worth $1,000. I don't think it's worth 10 cents. I simply lied about it, that's all. Mr. Rose looked as frightened as though I had charged him with the offense. Hang it, man, can't you see how it happened? I saw the poor woman's pride and happiness hung on her faith in that picture. I tried to make her understand that it was worthless, but she wouldn't. I tried to tell her so, but I couldn't. I behaved like a maudlin ass, but you shan't pay for my infernal bungling. You mustn't buy the picture. Mr. Rose sat silent, tapping one glossy boot tip with another. Suddenly he turned on me a glance of stored intelligence. But you know, he said good-humoredly, I rather think I must. You haven't already? Oh, no, the offer's not made. Well, then, his look gathered a brighter significance. But if the picture's worth nothing, nobody will buy it, I groaned. Except, he continued, some fellow like me, who doesn't know anything. I think it's lovely, you know, I mean to hang it in my mother's sitting room. He rose and clasped my hand in his adhesive pressure. I'm awfully obliged to you for telling me this, but perhaps you won't mind my asking you not to mention our talk to Miss Copt. It might bother her, you know, to think the picture isn't exactly up to the mark, and it won't make a rap of difference to me. Mr. Rose left me to a sleepless night. The next morning my resolve was formed, and it carried me straight to Mrs. Fontage's. She answered my knock by stepping out on the landing, and as she shut the door behind her, I caught a glimpse of her devastated interior. She mentioned, with a careful avoidance of the note of pathos on which our last conversation had closed, that she was preparing to leave that afternoon, and the trunks obstructing the threshold showed that her preparations were nearly complete. They were, I felt certain, the same trunks that, strapped behind a rattling vettura, had accompanied the bride and groom on that memorable voyage of discovery, of which the booty had till recently adorned her walls. And there was a dim consolation in the thought that those early inns in coral and Swiss wood carving, in lava and alabaster, still lay behind the worn locks, in the security of worthlessness. Mrs. Fontage, on the landing, among her strapped and corded treasures, maintained the same air of stability that made it impossible, even under such conditions, who regard her flight as anything less dignified than a departure. It was the moral support of what she tacitly assumed that enabled me to set forth with proper deliberation the object of my visit, and she received my announcement with an absence of surprise that struck me as the very flower of tact. Under cover of these mutual assumptions, the transaction was rapidly concluded, and it was not till the canvas passed into my hands that, as though the physical contact had unnerved her, Mrs. Fontage suddenly faltered. "It's the giving it up," she stammered, disguising herself to the last, and I hastened away from the collapse of her splendid effrontery. I need hardly point out that I had acted impulsively, and that reaction from the most honorable impulses is sometimes attended by moral perturbation. My motives had indeed been mixed enough to justify some uneasiness, but this was allayed by the instinctive feeling that it is more venial to defraud an institution than a man. Since Mrs. Fontage had to be kept from starving by means not wholly defensible, it was better that the obligation should be borne by a rich institution than an impecunious youth. I doubt, in fact, if my scruples would have survived a night's sleep, had they not been complicated by some uncertainty as to my own future. It was true that, subject to the purely formal assent of the committee, I had full power to buy for the museum, and that the one member of the committee likely to dispute my decision was opportunely traveling in Europe. But the picture once in place, I must face the risk of any expert criticism to which chance might expose it. I dismissed this contingency for future study, stored the Rembrandt in the cellar of the museum, and thanked heaven that Crozier was abroad. 6 months later, he strolled into my office. I had just concluded, under conditions of exceptional difficulty, and on terms unexpectedly benign, the purchase of the great Bartley Reynolds, and this circumstance, by relegating the matter of the Rembrandt to a lower stratum of consciousness, enabled me to welcome Crozier with unmixed pleasure. My security was enhanced by his appearance. His smile was charged with amiable reminiscences, and I inferred that his trip had put him in the humor to approve of everything, or at least to ignore what fell short of his approval. I had therefore no uneasiness in accepting his invitation to dine that evening. It is always pleasant to dine with Crozier, and never more so than when he is just back from Europe. His conversation gives even the food a flavor of the Café Anglais. The repast was delightful, and it was not till we had finished a commembert which he must have brought over with him, that my host said, in a tone of after-dinner perfunctoriness, "I see you've picked up a picture or two since I left." I assented. The Bartley Reynolds seemed too good an opportunity to miss, especially as the French government was after it. "I think we got it cheap, Canu, said Crozier pleasantly. I know all about the Reynolds. It was the biggest kind of a haul, and I congratulate you. Best stroke of business we've done yet. But tell me about the other picture, the Rembrandt." I never said it was a Rembrandt. I could hardly have said why, but I felt distinctly annoyed with Crozier. "Of course not. There's Rembrandt on the frame, but I saw you'd modified it to Dutch school. I apologize." He paused, but I offered no explanation. "What about it?" he went on. "Where did you pick it up?" As he leaned to the flame of the cigar lighter, his face seemed ruddy with enjoyment. "I got it for a song," I said. "1,000, I think. Have you seen it?" I asked abruptly. "Went over the place this afternoon, and found it in the cellar. Why hasn't it been hung, by the way?" I paused a moment. "I'm waiting, too, to have it varnished." "Ah." He leaned back, and poured himself a second glass of chartreuse. The smile he confided to its golden depths provoked me to challenge him with, "What do you think of it?" "The Rembrandt?" He lifted his eyes from the glass. "Just what you do. It isn't a Rembrandt. I apologize again. You call it, I believe, a picture of the same period?" "I'm uncertain of the period." H apostrophe M. He glanced appreciatively along his cigar. What are you certain of? That it's a damn bad picture, I said savagely. He nodded. Jay, just so. That's all we wanted to know. We are the committee, in short. You see, my dear fellow, if you hadn't been certain it was a damn bad picture, our position would have been a little awkward. As it is, my remaining duty, I ought to explain that in this matter I'm acting for the committee, is as simple as it's agreeable. I'll be hanged, I burst out, if I understand one word you're saying. He fixed me with a kind of cruel joyousness. Why, you will, he assured me. At least you'll begin to, when you hear that I've seen Miss Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.